Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States in this honorable court.
Thanks, Pam. Welcome to our virtual Fifth Circuit your presentations today. I'm guessing both of you are back in Texas, not affected by Hurricane Ida. Regardless, you may have your own stresses over there, but we do the best we can handling it this way, but we'll see how soon we get back to New Orleans. We just have the one case today, State of Texas versus United States and a lot of agents thereof. Each of you have probably argued in front of us before, though I don't know if I've had that pleasure. We'll start with the United States. Sarah Harrington, Department of Justice.
Thank you, Judge Southwick. May it please the court, Sarah Harrington for the federal defendants.
Could I hold off just a minute? I'm getting a message on my computer, meeting being recorded. Do I do something to get rid of it?
I think you have to push continue.
I did.
Before got it.
I don't usually see that. I was wondering if something, I didn't want to hit continue and have something bizarre happen. All right. Sorry, you still have, you only lost 4 seconds. You can return.
I'm okay with that. And I do want to extend my sympathies to you and your families who have been affected by Hurricane Ida. I hope everybody's okay.
Good.
So the United States respectfully requests that this court enter a stay pending appeal of the district court's aggressive and intrusive injunction. At its core, this is a case about enforcement discretion and non-enforcement discretion. And the Supreme Court has made clear that the Constitution affords non-enforcement discretion to the executive, particularly in the immigration context. Neither the district court nor the plaintiff states seriously contest that DHS cannot possibly detain every non-citizen who is removable or every non-citizen even who falls within Section 1226C or Section 1231A2.
Is there anything in the affidavits or either from your side or from Texas, Louisiana, that would indicate what the numbers are insofar as the effect of these guidelines? I know that the other side argues that we shouldn't just look at trade-offs, but there's been this overwhelming number of potential detentions. Is there any evidence here about what the guidance does versus not having the guidance?
There is some evidence. Thank you for that question, Judge Southwick. So the first is that I sort of have a couple of data points for you. ICE has been able to deploy 300 additional agents to assist state and local governments with the recent influx of people trying to cross the border at the southwest border. If the district court has its way, or if the plaintiff states have its way, presumably ICE would have to pull those agents off the border to go after people who have final orders of removal, whether or not they have any criminal history at all.
Well, now, counsel, let me just point you a little bit different direction. One of your affidavits, I think, Ms. Berg, talks about 200,000 people detained, stopped, something at the border in July. It seems to me what we're talking about in large part anyway are detainers, people who either have been arrested by state local officials or are in ICE custody, and what's to happen to them when they stop serving whatever sentence. Is there anything on those numbers and how this guidance affects releasing, as Judge District Judge said in his opinion, 68 detainers are released, and that hadn't happened in the previous administration.
What about
those sorts of numbers?
Okay, thank you. The evidence on that is not well developed. The affidavits from the states didn't provide sufficient detail for the United States to verify sort of what was going on with those detainers. But I can tell you just about the types of people who've been arrested. If you look at the 6-month period between February and July of 2021, there were approximately 26,000 arrests, and of those people, 20% had committed aggravated felonies, had aggravated felony convictions. If you look at the same period from the year before, there were 39,000 arrests, but only 8% of those people had aggravated felony convictions. And in actual numbers, that's about a little more than 2,000 additional people under the priorities with aggravated felony arrests who were arrested. And so, you know, if you have to understand that we're operating against this background where there are not sufficient resources to detain and remove the millions of people who are removable. And so every administration has had to make decisions about how it's going to use its scarce resources, what types of populations of removable non-citizens it's going to target for detention and removal. Under this.
Thank you. You have a lot to cover. Why don't you leave the numbers and move on?
Okay. But this is, I mean, I think this is important ground to talk about enforcement discretion, right? So the states argue that the APA creates a presumption of review of judicial review of agency action. And that's true with respect to many types of final agency action. But the opposite presumption applies when you're talking about enforcement and non-enforcement discretion decisions. The APA says that decisions that are committed to agency discretion by law are not reviewable under the APA. And enforcement and non-enforcement discretions are sort of the quintessential type of decision that's committed to agency discretion by law. Again, here we're operating in an environment where it is literally impossible to detain and remove everyone who is removable. And so every administration has had to, including this one, make decisions about how it's going to prioritize its scarce resources.
Well, counsel, one of the things that strikes me about this case, it puts it in at least a different look to it, though perhaps you're saying the effect's the same, is that in essence, at least from the state's viewpoint, the federal government has taken what Congress has said are mandatory detentions and removal and identified, I'll just pick a number, three of them that actually will be enforced and the rest we're not really going to deal with at this time. It's like announcing, it's the formality of it that's part of the problem, it seems to me. We're announcing that we're going to, I'll use some harsh words that you'll push back on, we're going to ignore what Congress says as to some of these. Take Castle Rock, which you seem to like to some extent. It's as if the police chief of Castle Rock in Colorado says, oh, we're not going to mess with domestic violence. We're going to deal with more serious crime. So before you arrest anybody for domestic violence, come to me. We got to talk about it. Even if you encounter them out on the street. What do you say to that? Other than I'm off base.
Well, so first, the priorities don't prohibit the detention or removal of people who fall presumptively outside the categories. So it's not as if we're saying we're going to refuse to enforce other provisions of law. But I think
it's fair to say that it's very hard for an agent to be authorized to, you've got to get approval, pre-approval, if you know about these folks. And if you encounter them outside, that you're not, it seems to me, entitled to detain them unless you have this pre-approval.
So I think there's no evidence that that's a difficult process. I think, you know, it has been
evident, but why don't you keep moving?
All right. Well, you mentioned Castle Rock and there, Justice Scalia, we do like that case because he explained that when a statute uses the word shall, when it's talking about enforcement, it's not mandatory that there is this background principle of enforcement discretion and non-enforcement discretion. And more recent cases from the Supreme Court, including United States versus Arizona, confirms that that discretion, enforcement discretion, is particularly potent in the immigration context.
Ms. Harrington, I have a question about the scope of your argument. I understand a main thrust of your argument is that, well, these statutes are directed at detention, so they don't require the government to initiate removal proceedings. That's within the government's discretion who to initiate removal proceedings against. But what's the government's position on when you do initiate a removal proceeding for someone who falls within 1226C? Then do you think you have discretion on detention, or is detention then mandatory?
So the way DHS operates is that once they initiate removal proceedings and decide to make an arrest of someone under 1226C, then they do detain that person. Now, I don't want to commit that it's true for every single person. There's a lot of moving pieces, but that is the operational sort of instructions that they operate under.
So there are not people who are in removal proceedings who fall within 1226C who under this guidance or these memos are out on the street.
So again, I don't want to say there's nobody because mistakes happen, but that is not sort of the
That's
structure.
That's not the policy though.
It's not right. That's not the structure of the priorities.
So your position is this just has to do with the discretion relates to when the government has to initiate the removal proceeding in the first place.
Right. And again, you know, I think the sort of statutory scheme acknowledges that Congress expects the executive to make large scale discretionary decisions about how it's going to allocate its resources, about which categories of removable non-citizens it's going to focus on, because there are millions of them and Congress has never come close to appropriating sufficient funds to actually detain and remove all those people. And, you know, Texas conspicuously ignores Section 1225 in Louisiana, but that's a provision that mandates detention of people who are crossing the border. And one of the priorities here is maintaining border security. Judge Graves, you look like you're about to ask a question. I'm sorry.
Well, I have a concern, and perhaps I shouldn't since nobody else has talked about it, but I have a concern about the status quo. I mean, I think the posture of this case is one where the district court has issued a preliminary injunction.
Yeah.
Which suggests to me that there will that the states will be pursuing some permanent injunction. Is that right?
As far as that's my understanding. Now, there will be new priorities that come out at the end of the month. And so that's going to change.
Could change the policy and procedure.
Correct. And all presumably right. Texas will challenge those.
Well, so I guess my concern is with regard to status quo, the preliminary injunction entered by the district court upset the status quo to the extent that when I heard you talk about the numbers, 6 months from 2020 versus 6 months in 2021 and the difference in the numbers. So obviously the status quo is one where now the new policy is being applied. That's what's been happening. And so the district court's stay, the district court's preliminary injunction upsets the status quo.
Yes.
Should I be concerned about maintaining the status quo pending some final resolution? Because here, this would be a stay pending a decision by a merits panel on the merits of the appeal.
Right.
And below, you have a preliminary injunction, which precedes a permanent injunction. So nothing's finished anyplace.
That's right, Judge Gaines.
The status quo is, though, that the current policy is being applied. And so what I'm asking you is whether or not that there is some law that favors maintaining the status quo until you get some merits, some final review on the merits at least.
I mean, I think that's generally what preliminary injunctive relief is meant to do, is maintain the status quo. Now, probably we would differ with the plaintiffs about what status quo you're supposed to look at in this kind of a situation. Our view is that you should, you know, we appreciate the administrative stay that this panel entered. We would like that to be a stay pending appeal. If we prevail on appeal, we hope that the case would be dismissed because we think the plaintiffs don't have standing. We think these actions are not reviewable, and so their complaints should be dismissed. But there's also the balance of equities. And as I've explained, having the priorities in place, which again focus on public safety, border security, and national security, having those in place versus having no priorities at all has resulted in the arrest of more than 2,000 additional people with aggravated felony convictions in that 6 month period. And so Texas and Louisiana complain that they're afraid that crime is going to go up with the priorities in place. But in fact, all the evidence points in the opposite direction. And in the meantime, we are also securing the border and trying to prevent an influx of people. If we really have to focus our energy on detaining and removing everyone who's covered by 1226C and 1231A2, we're gonna have to pull agents off the border in the Rio Grande Valley and El Paso. Texas hasn't really spoken to that, but I imagine that's not what they want to happen. But that would be the inevitable.
Let me ask you about that. It seems to me that there's a reality here that the evidence seems to support, though the evidence is preliminary stage. And we're not talking about everybody being detained in these categories. What we're talking about is it's not an affirmative injunction. It's one of the things that the judge made clear. It's saying that you cannot be following these formal guidance that has been promulgated. So it seems to me, one of my questions on irreparable injury, to the extent you argue we're going to have to move all our assets around and start detaining everybody subject to 1226, 1231, I don't think that's the reality. You're still going to be subject to the numbers problem that you've addressed. So tell me, what is a fair assessment of the difference between the world with the stay that you want of the preliminary injunction and the world without the stay?
So the world, it's true that the district court clarified in response to our request for a stay that we have not been ordered to detain or remove any particular people. But it is very clear that the injunction prevents us, as you say, from using the priorities. And so we would have to operate in an environment where there are no priorities.
Well, there are no formal priorities from Ojai, but I would imagine out there on the border and other places where this would have effect, there are some sort of prioritization going on now.
Well, I mean, there is now because the priorities are in place. I guess I would say two things to that. First, the logic of the district court's decision is that if we do adopt new priorities, we would have to prioritize detaining and removing everyone in 1226C and 1231A2 before we could go after anybody else. That is the logic of the district court's decision. But second, having kind of informal secret priorities at a lower level isn't the kind of thing that should, you know, that's not really in service of good government. And
but we're talking about irreparable injury. I'm not talking about what the outcome of this case is, just the irreparable injury that we need to find in order to stop the preliminary injunction long term.
Right. So it's it's a threat to public safety. If you go back to the numbers that you asked about that I talked about, the 6 month period from this year to last year, the priority scheme that was in place a year ago basically prioritized everyone, which is sort of similar to an environment you would be operating in with no priority scheme. And that system, compared to what we have now, meant 2,000 fewer people in a 6 month period with aggravated felony convictions who were arrested. And so to the extent we have evidence of the actual effects on public safety, I think that's serious evidence that it is helping public safety. We also, again, have more people at the border trying to stem the flow of people coming across the border, which has increased rapidly in the last year or two. And all of that, you know, inures to the benefit of plaintiffs like, you know, Texas and Louisiana.
Let me ask you about this. We just had this one argument today. I think we may have a little extra time to the extent we need it. What are the possibility of staying the injunction, but just outside of Texas and Louisiana, to make it a limited injunction, in other words, to Texas and Louisiana, but have no effect outside, and so we would not stay the nationwide effect of it?
So that would be preferable to a nationwide injunction. I don't want to try to talk you out of that, but I think staying the injunction altogether is preferable to that for some of the reasons I've given.
What do you make of the DAPA case? There may be a lot of DAPA cases and a lot of Texas versus Texas versus United States case, the 2015 Jerry Smith opinion that did talk about nationwide and array for nationwide injunctions in that case. Is this distinguishable?
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, that's a hard case for us. I'm going to be honest about that. And, you know, we generally think that nationwide injunctions are not appropriate. We understand this court's precedent saying that they might be more appropriate in the immigration context than not. You know, here where we're not being enjoined to do anything affirmative, maybe that's a context in which you could just have a limited injunction to Texas and Louisiana. But again, I think that not staying the injunction, having injunction in place, is more likely to create the kind of harms that Texas and Louisiana are pointing to, because it would prevent the agencies from really focusing on public safety, border security, and national security. And it's that focus that's going to...
Well, the DAPA case certainly says that, especially in the immigration context, a nationwide injunction may be appropriate. But, you know, the district court here expressed a lot of doubt about the propriety of nationwide injunctions generally. But then he seemed to think that, as I read it, that the DAPA case required him to impose one here, whereas injunctions and especially their scope are always a matter of equitable discretion. So I wonder if, do you read the DAPA case as saying you have to, once there's a violation, impose a nationwide injunction or in immigration cases, or just the courts have that discretion?
Oh, just the latter. Thank you, Judge Costa, for that question. I think the DAPA case suggests that courts have the discretion to do that if they want to, and that maybe that discretion is greater in an immigration case than in a different type of case, but it's certainly not mandatory.
Speaking of the nationwide injunctions, and I know we're over, is it okay to ask a few questions, Judge Southwick?
Please, we have extra time today, I think.
On the nationwide injunction issue, I saw that similar cases to this one were brought in Arizona and Florida. Both were dismissed and they're now being appealed by the states in those cases. Are there any other pending cases out there and challenging this enforcement policy?
Oh, that's a great question. I think there may be one more, but I can, if the court wants, I can get back to you in rebuttal about that. I'll ask my team, but it's not coming to me right now. But as you suggest, those two cases were dismissed. Arizona and Montana, who are co-plaintiffs, asked for an injunction pending appeal that was denied recently by the Ninth Circuit. So, you know, we think the proper disposition of this case is also that the case should be dismissed because the priorities are not reviewable and because the states have no standing.
Well, one final question. I know the government's brief talks about other administrations have had enforcement priorities, similar memos. Can you just talk a little bit about those? And and what classes they prioritized or didn't prioritize, classes of immigrants?
Sure. So the last administration, the Trump administration, their priorities basically said that they're going to prioritize everyone who's removable. And so, you know, query whether that's very different from having no priorities. You know, I mean, I think they meant it. They wanted to go after everybody, but they didn't sort of put certain categories above other categories. In the Obama administration, there were various different iterations of priorities memos. They targeted similar categories to what this administration is targeting. They're trying to go after public safety, national security, and border security. And so, you know, there's sort of some differences at the margins, but those are basically the same types of priorities that we are pursuing here. And again, I think it's inherent in the system that there has to be some sort of prioritization given the lack of sufficient funds or physical or personnel capacity to actually detain and remove everybody who's removable.
Any other questions, gentlemen? All right, Mr. Wilson, I don't think you need to be worried about your time. You may get some extra as well. We'll hear from you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'd like to begin with the statutes at issue here, 1226C and 1231A2. I'd like to begin there because I think both the text of the statute, the structure of the statutes, and also the way the Supreme Court has interpreted these statutes require show that they're mandatory. First, the statutes both say shall. The Supreme Court has recognized over and over again that shall at least usually connotes a mandatory requirement. Second, to talk about the structure of the statutes. If shall doesn't mean must in 1226C, the structure of the statute really doesn't make any sense. We've got 1226A, which says the Attorney General, now DHS, may detain people. 1226C.
Mr. Wilson, why doesn't all these differences you're making, which I understand they make sense based on the text and structure, but why doesn't that just go to whether someone has to be detained once they're in a removal proceeding? So someone who fits 1226C has to be detained. It's mandatory. Someone in some of the other sections, it's discretionary whether they're actually detained once the removal proceeding is initiated. But why does that require the initiation of the removal proceeding as opposed to determining their detention status once they're in a removal proceeding?
Your Honor, 1226A at least specifically speaks to may detain pending that determination. I think 1226C should be read exactly the same way. And in any event, Your Honor, as Judge Southwood noted, and as the district court made extremely clear, this injunction doesn't require the district court, or excuse me, the United States, to detain or remove or institute removal proceedings against anyone. What it says is that the memoranda issue in this case are contrary to law or arbitrary, capricious, or procedurally invalid.
I'm trying to understand the state's position. I mean, take someone who's released from a state prison or county jail who has a drug conviction, does not fall within the enforcement priorities in the memo. I thought it's the state's position that the federal government must institute removal proceedings against that alien who has a drug conviction and then obviously must detain him. Is that not your position?
Your Honor, I think we certainly asked for the district court to enter an affirmative injunction. The district court was very clear that it wasn't. What the district court was very clear that it was doing was enjoining these specific memoranda. To sort of talk about some of the folks who have been released here, I mean, we've got, you know, people who under, I think, any reasonable definition of public safety would be serious threats to public safety. People who've been arrested with more than 50 pounds of marijuana, a person in Louisiana who's required to register as a sex offender. We're not saying here on appeal that the United States has to institute removal proceedings against anyone. What we're saying is that the district court correctly determined that the memoranda violated the APA in several respects.
I guess I'm trying to figure out what the practical meaning of all this is then, because the government says it agrees that once it brings a removal proceeding against someone who fits within 1226C, so these people who have serious drug convictions in the past, that it does have to detain them. So And you're saying, well, we're not requiring them to start removal proceedings. That's still within their discretion that they've always had. So I guess I don't know. It seems kind of academic if that's the distinction.
Well, two points, Your Honor. First, I think that's what the district court said when it issued its negative injunction. Second, I just don't think it's in this case as to whether the United States is required or not required to institute removal proceedings against anyone. What we have here is an APA challenge to the memoranda. I think it would be a very different case if what we showed up and said was, you know, the government must institute removal proceedings against certain individuals.
But I thought that's the whole linchpin of Judge Tipton's order, because on this issue of whether this is committed to agency discretion, the feds are saying who we bring removal proceedings against is committed to agency discretion. And our memo says these are the three categories we prioritize. And Judge Tipton says, well, no, there's no enforcement discretion on this because these statutes are mandatory. So it seems to me the argument for you has to be not that they're not just about detention, but the statutes are also guide the limit the exercise of discretion and who is being pursued in removal proceedings in the first place.
No, Your Honor, I don't think that's right. The statutes speak very clearly to who must be detained. And again, 1226A talks about detaining pursuant to making that decision. So we think under 1231A2 and 1226C, the government does not have any discretion not to detain. What they do after that, Your Honor, I think would be a separate case. I don't think we've really briefed that in detail. We didn't bring claims on that to that regard.
Well, Mr. Wilson, let me ask you where that takes us. The Supreme Court has told us recently that people cannot be held in pre-removal detention indefinitely. It seems to me your argument is suggesting everyone has to be detained subject to the mandatory language. And therefore, legally, they must be processed for removal. It's not really discretionary at that point, because at least they have to be released from detention. If it becomes unduly prolonged, 6 months as a rule of thumb. Any reaction to that?
Your Honor, it's certainly right that other Supreme Court precedent may sort of downstream require other actions. Again, I don't think that the requirement to detain is what, or excuse me, the requirement to remove is what's really going on in this case. And in any event, Your Honor, I would also say that past sort of determining that this was contrary to law, or the memoranda were contrary to law, the district court also determined that they were arbitrary, capricious, and procedurally invalid. And one of the hallmarks of APA review under the Chenery principle is we evaluate what the agency did for the reasons the agency gave. So there's certainly other. The district court made other holdings that I don't think really turn on sort of this distinction in any event.
Mr. Wilson, you referred to this as a negative injunction, but on page 158 of the district court's opinion and order, there were four different items where the district court said to ensure compliance with this preliminary injunction, the court further orders the following. And then there were four things which it orders the government to do. Now, I understand there has been some, I guess, explanation of what that means, but it sounds to me like you got to take some affirmative steps, which sounds to me like a positive injunction. So does the government have to do those things now or not?
Your Honor, I would refer the court to the hearing on the stay in the district court and the argument there, and also the orders that the district court judge subsequently issued. He made very clear in that hearing that he thought that those were sort of discovery related issues. He expected that the government had that information, and the district court judge.
Well, discovery is usually done by the parties. This is something he's ordering the government to do. And my only question is, are you, is the government still required to do that under the terms of this order? You're referring me to a hearing. I appreciate that. Tell me what he did.
What the district court did, and it's either at ECF 90 or 92, what the district court did is push those dates off, said he thought that that was information the government would have, and then also said...
But the answer is, I don't know why you don't want to answer me. It sounds like the answer is the government is required to do it under the terms of his original opinion and order. Is that right or not?
I think under the terms of the preliminary injunction on its face, that's correct. I think in ECF 90 and 92, the district court made clear that if the government thought this was particularly burdensome or the government couldn't comply with this, he was perfectly happy to talk to them about what...
So he's conducting discovery? Is that what he's doing?
Beg pardon, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
The judge is conducting the discovery for the parties? You said
he's doing
the discovery matter?
I think that the district court judge referred to it as a case management tool and said he was perfectly open to discussing this with the United States at further proceedings if it was particularly burdensome or troublesome.
All right.
Let me ask you, Mr. Wilson, about your concerns with the language of the guidelines of the memos. I think there's been an acknowledgement, I'm not holding you to it if you tell me otherwise, that there has been in the past a need, if not to prioritize, at least to limit by ICE and other enforcement officials the number of people who can be detained regardless of this language. You can tell me if that's right or wrong, but it seems to me if that's right, the real argument here is the formality of this memo, that it's an announcement, almost an affront to Congress. And here are your, I'll make up a new number, here are your 10 categories of people who must be detained, and we're announcing only five of them, or four of them, or three of them are priorities to us. Some of the others we may snatch up from time to time. Is that really an unfair way to look at this argument? I'm not saying it fails for that reason, but is the problem really here that it's formal national guidance that in a way undermines the mandatory nature of what Congress said?
Your Honor, a couple of responses. First, I don't think that's quite right. I mean, the United States has certainly asserted in their briefing that there's no way they can detain everyone and everyone has
to. You're fading out just a bit, Mr. Wilson. I don't know if our IT people can take care of that or whether it's at your end.
My apologies, Your Honor. I'll try to speak up. Is that better?
I need to speak up too, probably, but go ahead.
So I was going to make a couple of points, Your Honor. First, they've certainly sort of asserted that everyone has to have priorities and there were past priorities. That's not something they put before the district court. If they want to make sort of an argument, so the district court took evidence. They could introduce whatever evidence they wanted. The district court then took approximately 3 months writing an extremely thorough 160-page opinion. I think the first time any of this came into the case, or at least what they're relying on in the Court of Appeals, was evidence they put in after the preliminary injunction for purposes of a stay. So what I would say, Your Honor, is if they want to sort of make an argument related to congressional acquiescence or, literal impossibility or something like that, they can certainly put that evidence in front of the district court in further proceedings. But I just don't think it's there right now. Second, Your Honor, we know from the Homan Declaration that we entered in response to some of this, that for various reasons, the United States has decreased its detention capacity. They certainly have as the Homan Declaration says, in both the Trump and the Obama administrations, ICE reprogrammed money. ICE has canceled sort of contracts that they had with third parties to detain certain aliens. And that has had the effect of cutting their detention capacity approximately in half. As the Homan Declaration says, in 2019, ICE had an average of over 50,000 people detained a day and highs around 56,000 a day. And now they're saying something like 26. So at a bare minimum, Your Honor, whatever sort of priorities they have to or having to come up with, they've decreased on purpose their detention capacity significantly. So it's certainly a problem, Your Honor, that they have sort of flouted the priorities that Congress put into law. And it's also a problem if I'd refer the court to the opinion in DeMoor v. Kim, where the Supreme Court recognizes that Congress was writing 1226C and 1231A2 precisely to get at this problem, right? Congress recognized in findings of fact that the old INS, which was responsible for this at the time, was not detaining and not removing criminal aliens, and that had various negative consequences, in part because of the extremely high recidivism rate, which Congress found at the time was in the 70s, and which evidence out of Tarrant County shows, or at least Tarrant County in Texas is also in the 70s in this case. So it's certainly a problem that they're ignoring Congress's express instruction. It's further a problem.
In Castle Rock, the law was passed because there was evidence that law enforcement wasn't taking protective orders seriously enough. So how do you get around Castle Rock and Justice Scalia's point that there's a long tradition of mandatory arrest statutes that don't eliminate enforcement discretion?
Oh, sure, Your Honor, several ways. First, Castle Rock is written against that backdrop. I mean, the court block quotes the sort of backdrop of enforcement discretion. Here, as DeMoor tells us, Congress was explicitly trying to remove that discretion in for these categories of aliens. Second, Your Honor, Castle Rock comes back to the point several times that, well, what are the police there to do if they don't know where the person is or can't find them or something like that? That's not the case we have here, as demonstrated by the declaration we have from TDCJ, which shows that ICE is, again, affirmatively rescinding detainers and affirmatively rescinding detainers for some subset of people who are, you know, pretty serious criminals.
So it seems, going back to our earlier conversation, the state's position, and this is what I understood the state's position to be, is that statutes like 1226C do dictate that removal proceedings themselves have to be commenced, not just that people in those removal proceedings have to be detained. Is that? I'm still a little confused on what your position is.
No, Your Honor, I don't think that's what the preliminary injunction we're up on requires.
If 1226C doesn't eliminate the government's discretion about who it wants to put in removal proceedings, then why is the memo problematic? I mean, I thought the whole basis for the district court finding the memo to be contrary to law, et cetera, is that it says the government has discretion in who it brings enforcement proceedings against. But you're saying 1226C doesn't dictate that it brings enforcement proceedings against everyone.
Your Honor, I'm saying that 1226C does what it says, which is require that certain categories of criminal aliens be detained.
And does that also mean they have to be, you have to bring removal proceedings against them? Or again, does it just say you have to be detained once that removal proceeding is initiated on the government's behalf?
You know, Your Honor, we're certainly aware that when it comes to instituting removal proceedings, the government has, you know, various levels of discretion. I would submit that for these particular categories of criminal aliens, Congress certainly required that they be detained. Again, I think 1226C says that 1226A at least very strongly suggests that the detention decision is upstream of the removal decision, where 1226A says that aliens may be detained pending that decision. Again, Your Honor, I see.
You're saying they have to be detained even if they're on, it's a separate issue. Even if the government doesn't want to remove them, they have to detain them. Is that your position?
Your Honor, I think the statute certainly says that they must be detained.
You can't detain someone without a removal proceeding. You can't just detain them without any immigration proceeding, right?
Your Honor, there might be lots of things downstream of that decision. But I think what the statute says is that they must be detained.
One of the things you've heard in our time is that the injunction itself at this stage doesn't require anybody to be removed. But it does seem to me your analysis does require us to think in those terms, because that's the support. It is or is not the support for the relief that you have gotten so far. Let me ask you this. It seems to me part of your argument on the limits on discretion that's relevant here is very evidence-based. You have these dueling affidavits to some extent, Mr. Berg and Holman or whatever it is. Yeah, Mr. Holman. It seems to me that if the reality is, and I don't think we know what the reality is, that there are four more people subject to these statutes, mandatory detention, then there's the ability for the U.S. government to detain. And if that is the reality, you have also on top of that, this enormous amount of people at the border who may not be subject to these statutes in the first place, but also have to be dealt with. Isn't that part of what's going on here? And do we have enough evidence to really say that there's a necessity for prioritization? The formality of it is not really the problem, though it does, in a way, I'll say it's a little bit unattractive that the federal government executive branch is saying we're not going to follow Congress on some of what it's saying. But if that's the reality, that this you have this numbers disconnect between the people subject to mandatory detention and the ability of the federal government to do it, then there has to be some sort of prioritization.
A few points, Your Honor. First, the evidence in the record really clearly shows that, and this is from the Holman Declaration, that they have purposely decreased their detention capacity. Second, again,
well, that means they could do more. They may not be able to do everything that Congress is saying is mandatory, but they could do more. Is that basically what that much would support?
They certainly could do more. Again, to be clear, Your Honor, I don't think the preliminary injunction here requires that. And I'd like to point quickly again to the district court's opinion isn't just based on the idea that this is contrary to law. The injunction that the district court issued in the opinion of the company also said that the memoranda issued were arbitrary and capricious and procedural invalid because they didn't go through notice and comment. And it's certainly true in APA proceedings, Your Honor, that even if the government can do something, it can't do it arbitrary and capriciously or in a procedurally invalid way. I mean, this comes from, you know, dozens of cases, including Supreme Court cases. Regents is the first one that comes to mind where the court says, you know, perhaps this was in the power of the government to do, but they didn't do it in the right way. So that those issues.
Those APA procedural requirements like notice and comment only come to us if it's not committed to agency discretion as an enforcement matter. I have one last question. Is there a Supreme Court case you can cite that has ordered law enforcement, both criminal and immigration, I'm talking about, to institute proceedings against an individual or a class of individuals?
What I would say, Your Honor, is that the Supreme Court has repeatedly described 1226C and 1231A2 as mandatory. Those are in a slightly different context.
Right. In all those cases, the plaintiffs were the detainees were bringing the challenge, and they were already in immigration proceedings, right? In all those cases, Jennings, Guzman.
Guzman Chavez, Preap, Damore. It's certainly true that those cases arose in a different posture, Your Honor. What I would say is that the Supreme Court has said these provisions are mandatory in all of those cases. And as recently as the Guzman Chavez case, the United States appeared to agree, as the district court noted in somewhere around 68 of its opinion, citing the Solicitor General's briefs in that case.
But so directly on my question, you know, I'm talking state, federal, criminal, immigration. Is there a Supreme Court case that has ordered the government to bring institute proceedings that the government hadn't already brought in the posture of the case?
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor. I wouldn't say that I would hesitate to say that there are none. I'm certainly not aware of it. What I would say is that's not what that is expressly what the district court said its injunction is not requiring.
One last run at this, and I'm sorry, Mr. Wilson, you've given your best to respond to Judge Costa on this. One of the things in the DAPA case, and it's Judge King in her dissent that quotes it, but it's from the plaintiff Texas brief. In the briefing on appeal, plaintiffs refute the mistaken premise that this lawsuit challenges DHS's decision not to remove certain unauthorized aliens, making clear that this lawsuit, obviously just that one, has never challenged any decision by executive to initiate a forego removal. It seems to me that we can't disconnect mandatory detention from what happens thereafter. They're going to be detained. They can't just be housed for the rest of their lives. They have to be subject to mandatory removal proceedings or released after some period of time. Obviously, we're looking at a stay of a preliminary injunction here. We're not looking at the overall merits. Can we really ignore that, though, in our decision, that if what you're seeking is an end to the kind of guided discretion in these memos on who is to be detained, that necessarily means those people have to be subject to removal?
It could, Your Honor. I don't think it necessarily does. I mean, again, the government may exercise its discretion downstream in various ways
to release them. I mean, ultimately, they decide not to bring removal. They have to release them, so they're exercising the discretion just a little later.
That would ultimately probably be true, Your Honor. I mean, I'd like to offer a couple of points. First, we think that these statutes are not discretionary. And second, as I mentioned to Judge Costa, there are also arbitrary and capricious claims and claims related to procedural invalidity in this case. So what I would say is even if the court were to conclude that these priorities were viable under some set of circumstances, we think that for the reasons the district court identified, they're arbitrary and capricious and procedurally invalid in this circumstance.
All right.
If these statutes are so clear in being mandatory, why didn't Texas challenge the portions of the memo in the DAPA case that had similar enforcement priorities? I mean, I'm looking at Judge Smith's opinion. It says part of DAPA involves the secretary's decision not to enforce the immigration laws as to a class of what he deems to be low priority aliens. But importantly, the states have not challenged those priority levels. And then it was just the DAPA grant of DAPA.
I don't recall the precise statutes at issue there. What I would say is that DAPA was a very different case that was conferring status on hundreds of thousands of individuals solely in Texas. It's certainly true that sometimes, Your Honor, you may pick the big thing in front of you rather than picking every possible thing you can bring a claim on. I certainly wasn't in this office at the time then, so I'm not sure I could speak to our litigation strategy, even if it weren't privileged.
One thing I didn't ask you, but I did ask your friend on the other screen, the nationwide injunction aspect of this. Does this really fit what was said in the DAPA case? If you start from the proposition, which maybe you don't, that nationwide injunction should be by far the exception, isn't this distinguishable from DAPA? Not that that means it would not be a nationwide injunction here. Just how do you defend a nationwide injunction?
Sure, Your Honor. I mean, I think what the DAPA case says is that when it comes to immigration law, Congress and the courts have repeatedly said there should be a uniform application of the immigration laws. I think also some of the same issues are at play here as in the DAPA case. Once individuals are released, they may be free to move against the states, free to move among the states, that is.
Really, more of a problem for DAPA than it would be here it seems to me, moving around to take advantage of DAPA and the opportunities for people otherwise removable was a much more significant motivation than it would be here. And here is a matter of, isn't that a distinction?
Your Honor, I think there were probably more individuals at issue in DAPA. Maybe the cost would have been different. But under the theory of harm that we have, it seems likely to me that people might move between states and then, you know, recidivate in Texas or create medical costs or something like that for the state of Texas, as we argue before the district court.
All right. Thank you. You have time for a rebuttal, Ms. Harrington.
Thank you so much. I'd like to start first. Judge Costa, you asked about the fourth case out there, and I'm sorry I'd forgotten the name. It's in the Southern District of Texas called Coe versus Biden, a suit brought by a sheriff and an organization that purports to represent ICE employees. And there's no injunction yet in that case.
Answer his question, that's the only other case?
Yeah, other than the Ninth Circuit and the 11th Circuit cases that he identified, yeah, the Florida and the Arizona-Montana case. I just have a few points I'd like to make on rebuttal, if I can. Mr. Wilson says that the case basically has nothing to do with constraining the agency's discretion about initiating removal proceedings. But in fact, the memo does direct priority, you know, sort of the exercise of discretion towards the priority groups with respect to initiating removal proceedings. So, while the memo is enjoined, it does sort of constrain the agency's discretion about how to direct those efforts. I also want to emphasize the number of places.
Let me stop you there. Where are you talking about? Is this the February memo?
Yes.
And where are you saying there's this enforcement, just a weekly, that's weekly reporting?
So if you look at page 170 of the addendum to our stay motion,
okay,
it talks about all the different decisions that are affected by the memos.
Okay, I'll look at that. Thank you.
Okay. So I just want to emphasize the number of different places in these removal proceedings, sort of in the chain of events that happen, where there is enforcement discretion. There's discretion about whether to initiate enforcement proceedings by issuing a notice to appear. There's then discretion about whether to make an arrest. Generally, when a notice to appear is issued, there hasn't been a determination made about whether someone falls within Section 1226C, because under the categorical approach and the modified categorical approach, it's not an easy determination to make always. And sometimes there are facts that are unknowable before you have someone, because 1226C, for example, covers people who've ever been addicted to drugs since entering the country. That's not something that the agencies would necessarily know about. So once they initiate removal proceedings, there's discretion about whether to make an arrest. Then there's discretion about, all along the way, the Supreme Court emphasized in Reno versus AADC, that at any point along the way, the agency has great discretion about whether to abandon the course of attempting to remove someone. And so the memo that's been enjoined directs discretion and prioritization with respect to all of those decisions, and that's a serious harm that's being inflicted on the government while that's enjoined, because they can't prioritize public safety, national security, and border security. I just want to point out that the states have no answer to Heckler versus Cheney, Chicago versus Morales, and Castle Rock versus Gonzalez. Mr. Wilson says, the state legislature was acting against the background of non-enforcement, but here Congress is trying to constrain that discretion. But the only thing he can point to is the use of the word shall, which was also used in the statute at issue in Castle Rock.
Doesn't he also have some evidence from the congressional background, to the extent that's relevant? There's different opinion on that. This was an effort to require INS to tighten up and to be more aggressive in detention and removal. Isn't that part of the backstory for the new language?
So, Congress has in many ways expanded the class of people who are subject to removal. And in many of those provisions, it uses the word shall. Also in Section 1225, it uses the word shall about removing people who are attempting to cross the border.
Okay, you may be getting to it, but my only point is, it seems to me there is something that Mr. Wilson has and the briefing does have, that Congress was concerned about not being aggressive enough in removing people. And so this legislation with shall was intended to stop that.
But Congress
doesn't necessarily make it 100%. So, that's all I'm asking. I'm not saying it wins the case for it, but isn't that in the legislative backstory?
So, I mean, two things. As Judge Costa points out, that was also true in Castle Rock, and that wasn't enough just using the word shall. Congress operate, you know, legislative.
Did you say yes? The answer to that, yes. That is part of the legislative history.
That is part of the legislative history, but I'm saying that's not enough to signal that Congress wanted to take
away. Yes, and then move.
Yes, but yeah, I apologize. That's not enough to overcome this background presumption of non-reviewability of enforcement discretion decisions. I mean, the larger context is that Congress has never come close to appropriating enough money to enforce all of these shall provisions. And Mr. Wilson keeps saying that we intentionally reduced our bed capacity. We don't agree with that. Many contractors have canceled their contracts. There's a pandemic that reduces our capacity. But even if overnight we could magically quintuple our bed space, which we can't do, but even if we could, we would still be orders of magnitude away from the number being able to house the number of people who are covered by 1231A2 and 1226C.
What is the necessary predicate for, I'm sorry, Greg, for the discretion that you're talking about? And obviously, you responded to the evidence Mr. Wilson had from the Holman affidavit. But if, in fact, there was evidence at some point, not here yet, that ICE could do more, and part of the effect of these priorities is just sort of an announcement somewhere within the administration that some of these people should not be detained, not announcement. It's driven by that, which will probably never come out in evidence. Isn't a necessary predicate for this is that DHS, ICE, whoever can't do more than it's doing, as opposed to it wants to pull back from removing certain kinds of people who they could remove. Isn't the evidence you're talking about essential to your argument that DHS cannot do more?
Well, what I would say is the point of the priorities is not that ICE and DHS should do less. It's a question of with what they have, where should they direct their energies? Okay. And so, and we've seen the results, 2000 more people in a 6-month period with aggravated felony convictions were removed with the priorities in place than without the priorities in place. Okay. So it's about targeting what we view as the greatest threats to our country, to the border, to the national security, and to public safety. If I can take 1 second and address the reporting requirements that Judge Graves asked about. It's true that the district court said in response to the stay motion that those were not part of the injunction, but it's also true, as you suggest, that they do seem like discovery orders, which a judge cannot order. That's something that, without the request of a party, at least. And so we're not aware of any authority that the district court has to order the government to comply with these sort of reporting requirements. And so we would ask that those be stayed as part of any stay of the injunction.
Go ahead, Judge Costa.
This is just a quick question. You mentioned at the outset that new guidance is coming. And I think way back in the spring, they said it was coming soon. Now I hear the end of September. I mean, I know these things, you're not in control of them, but really, what is the best you know about when that new guidance is coming?
It's end of September. My agency friends understand that is not a deadline we can blow. I'm sure you understand there's been a lot going on with Afghanistan and other things going on at the border and the pandemic situation that has created more work. I'm not giving excuses, just as an explanation. That's why it's taking longer than we've expected. But end of September, we view as a firm deadline to have the final priorities out.
I think it's a February memo said 90 days. You would remember better. So anyway, these things slide.
Yes. No, I've emphasized with my friends that this is a firm deadline. So
a question I have about that, the initial order, follow-up order, I forget which, said that if the injunction stays in, on the predicate that the injunction stays in place, that by September 3, you were to indicate the defendants were to indicate exactly how they would be making these enforcement decisions. That's been postponed until October, I suppose, but that still is a requirement. How you'd be making these decisions.
Right. The judge ordered us to tell him what priorities we would use, what legal rules we think would apply. There will be new priorities, the final priorities before October. So I think that will guide what we tell the district court at that point.
Okay. Well, thank you both for your assistance to us today. I have one final question for Ms. Harrington that is a concern to nobody else who is on the screen right now. What room are you in? That looks like a main justice room and one of those forgotten attorney generals in the background.
Perhaps one that you've been in before, Judge Suffolk. This is the Civil Division main conference room. So
yeah, I believe that's what that was. Here.
Yes.
Norma Heine used to go to the AAG's office, I suppose.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Your old stomping grounds.
Well, I haven't stopped there in a while. Don't worry, Mr. Wilson. I have no favoritism to either side here. Thank you both.
Not at all, Your Honor.
We are adjourned.
Thank you.